Welcome back to the Cyclist Magazine podcast. I'm your host, James Spender, and actually, for the first time in what feels like years, I'm not here on my own. Will Strickson, ladies and gentlemen, is back. Insert canned laughter, not canned laughter, canned clapping, canned applause that Will Strickson has made it back from Japan in one piece. You haven't done what Sean Connery does in You Only Live Twice and got Japanese, which obviously is totally inappropriate these days, so that's good. But you're looking the same. You haven't aged.
Glad to know. In the month, whatever it is since we last recorded one of these, I'm glad that I look the same age.
Do you feel like Japan took it out of you? It's quite an arduous thing to do, to go to a country which is like so remote from, well, it's not so remote, but as in just like massive language barrier, basically, and
different
stuff.
I think what got me, obviously, I've not done a 2-week holiday since I was quite young, and those 2-week holidays bit more relaxed, whereas this was 2 weeks of like quite intense activity. So we got back and I literally felt like I've been away for a year. London looked different, doesn't always. Felt like I was in a different country, and you're like, wow, it's in such a, you know, nice, polite community in Japan.
And then you come back to the UK and you're just like, why do I live here?
Happens all the time.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things was two favorite things, and they're both to do with the trains, which is a massive stereotype, but it's a stereotype for a reason in Japan, because their trains are sick. Number one, when a Shinkansen, which is the name for a bullet train, gets to its terminal station, then the little dude comes along and he just flicks every seat round. It's on a little pivot.
He turns
it round, so everyone's always facing in the direction of travel. So he just turns every single seat around, lovely. And then the train conductors, stewards, walking through, they're very clean, very Wes Anderson looking Shinkansen carriages. Every single door will stop and turn and bow. I think that's just amazing.
And they're so clean. We got on one that was, you know, clean, could have been really new because it was that clean. If it was in the UK, you'd be like, wow, this is amazing. But it was so old. There was a payphone in there that was obviously out of use.
I saw that. They're amazing. With a sign on it saying, which was actually in English, saying, don't use this payphone. It doesn't work anymore. I love the idea. It's like, I've got to call somebody to the payphone. It's just incredible. Did you notice the distinct lack of bins just everywhere?
Oh, my God, did I notice.
Isn't it mental?
Oh, it's such a pain.
Do you know why it is?
Is it the terrorism thing?
It is the terrorism thing. You're right. Yeah.
Because we've reduced our bins in big cities in the UK for a similar reason, but you know, we still have some bins.
We do still have some bins. But no, this is because in the 90s, there was the sarin, I think you say sarin or sarin, gas attacks by like a kind of terrorist political organisation where they let off sarin gas in the tube stations, some of which were put in bins. And so at some point, another government, like ages later, just went, do you know what? We're going to say the no more bins, guys, because we don't want any more terrorist attacks, which kind of does seem like maybe a cost-saving exercise.
Yeah, and it does actually get rid of waste because partially just of who the Japanese are in terms of being clean. But secondly, you know, I feel like a lot of stuff on the streets these days is because of like overflowing bins.
Yeah, it's true. Foxes getting in, not even overflowing bins, just regular bins.
And also they have the thing where you're not meant to eat as you're walking, right? So if you picked up something up from the shop,
yeah,
you just stand outside the shop. Shop's got a bin, stick it in that bin. The only problem I can imagine, if you went in summer and you're racking up, you know, water,
yeah,
that could be a problem.
That could be a problem. Was it hot? Speaking of the weather,
we had quite a few hot days. Not like, you know, 30. Our last day was actually about 25.
So that positively was balmy. Did you see some blossom?
We did on said 25-degree day.
Perfect. And what was your favourite thing? What thing do you revisit in your Will Strickson mind when you close your eyes and you just think, wasn't that a wonderful holiday? Where would you like to go back to?
Hiroshima. Really took me by surprise. Obviously, I knew what Hiroshima was. Mm. And obviously, the actual Peace Park and stuff was very emotional and obviously quite harrowing in parts. But the actual town they've sort of rebuilt, Great vibe, great place.
What I thought was crazy is just, like, I didn't understand the extent of the decimation of Hiroshima, you know, Hiroshima of the 40s. But the speed at which all of that was rebuilt, you know, okay, on the one hand, yes, it's 80 years ago or 79 years ago. But on the other hand, just insane. Like, imagine like how long it takes us just to, I don't know, renovate an already existing building in this country, or like tear something down and build something in its place. I mean, Hammersmith Bridge, that will never get fixed, ever. Whereas the Japanese literally rebuilt an entire city whilst also somehow managing to coax people back to an incredibly harrowing place, which many people probably wouldn't have wanted to go back to. It's just insane. And it's, yeah, and it's such a, like, I don't know, it's been designed, I feel, with, it's like really, really, it worked really well, because if you kind of had a blank canvas, then there's obviously lots of things you can do that older cities can't do.
Yeah, and also, who knew that Hiroshima was known for its lemons? I didn't.
Is it known for its lemons?
It's known for its lemons. Biggest supplier of lemons in Japan, and they don't put a load of stuff on it to preserve, so they're really fresh and they're really sweet and it's very nice.
Nice. Did you enjoy the vending machines across Japan?
You know what? So the only time I actually benefited from the vending machine is when we were trying to avoid tourist queues throughout the trip, so getting up early. We got arguably too early to see to go to the bamboo forest in Kyoto, and it was dark and it was raining. So they had there was like a hot tea in there, which helped.
Well, lovely. Well, anyway, without further ado, because this is not a podcast about Will's adventures in Japan, this is a cycling podcast. We should introduce our guest today, which is Scott Sunderland. Scott turned pro in the 1990s and rode for TVM, for Lotto and GAN, amongst others. GAN, of course, a lot of people know Chris Boardman rode for GAN. In 2004, he became sports director with CSC, winning Paris-Roubaix, no less, the biggest and best of all the monuments, 2006 and 2007 with Cancellara. Then in 2009, Scott took on the Cervelo Test Team DS role, which again was a very successful big team. Seeing a bike sponsor take on a team like that was fairly novel for that time, I reckon. And then the big kind of power play money move, he went to Team Sky in 2010 and became the senior sports director. So had a hand in setting up everything that was to follow. Today, he is still in charge of various races. He's not doing sports directing stuff, but along with being the Flanders Classics race director, which is Tour of Flanders and Gent-Wevelgem, Amstel Gold Race. Just to check, Will's still listening. What's the other one in that quartet?
Omloop.
Oi, he was. He absolutely was. And now, as of particularly this, in a couple of weekends' time, Scott's big gig is as his ongoing race director for the Ride London Classique role. Ride London Classique, again, Will, are you listening? When is it going to happen?
I don't know. Always, every week.
Always, every week. No, he's wrong. It's May the 24th to the 26th. Three stages. Can you name where those stages are going to go, Will?
Essex.
That's true. Anywhere in particular?
Finishes in London.
Finishes in London. Would you like to have a guess at any of the places in Essex where stage two may go? You know, it's a salty place.
Maldon.
Yes.
And home, they'll go back there.
Home of the sea salt, exactly. A lot of clout. There's a lot of... Maldon's a powerhouse, isn't it, in Essex, when you think about its reach. Maldon sea salt in so many top restaurants around the world. Who'd have thought it?
Who'd have thought it? Home of Alex Dowsett as well.
Home of Alex Dowsett as well. Do you have either Alex Dowsett or Maldon sea salt in your cupboard?
I only have one.
And there we go, and that answers the question, what is Alex Dowsett up to now? He is in Will's cupboard stacking the shelves, because Will's got a vast cupboard to go with his vast house. Anyway, we're really deviating off the
Alex point. Dowsett, who actually did help with the Ryland Classic last year, assume he's going to continue that this year.
Well, there you go, it all comes around, doesn't it? So it all just about links up, and without further ado, we should probably just get into the interview. So let us welcome to the show Scott Sunderland. I mean, we can come to your regrets later, Scott. But no, I'm joking. I was more to the point. I'd like to talk about some of the highlights in your career, because your career is vast and long and spans much more than just turning pro in the 90s. You're, you know, effectively, we're talking today because you're very much ensconced in the biggest race in the UK calendar, the Ride London Classique, as race director. But before we come to that, just looking back from, I don't know, what, you know, 30 plus years in your career, which bits are the bits that stick out? Where was your purple patch? Was it that time at CSC with Bjarne and a massively informed Fabian Cancellara?
I think the highs and lows in life, but all the difficult challenges I don't regret because they made me who I am today and give me that, made my toolbox a lot fuller as in far as those experiences and so forth. And it's helped me to be where I am today, I think, because I have experience. I've got hands-on from doing that, the skills. But I think purple patches, I mean, there's some great ones. I mean, Cancellara's victory in Paro Bay and then followed by back-to-back with Stuart O'Grady, winning with Basso in the Giro, winning with Carlos Sastre in the Tour de France, and then him backing it up with a third place in Tour of Spain straight off from the Tour. I think he's one of the last few riders who's actually ridden both races back-to-back and podium doing both by winning one of them. But my riding career, I think I was just happy to survive that period, to be honest, of the 90s. I got through it, ended up having 3 years in the Conti team in Switzerland, 87 to 90, and then 90 through to 2004, into 2004 as a pro. So, yeah, a tough period, but hey, life isn't that easy. And I'm just happy I've got everything out of it that I could, and it's been a great trip along the way.
What was the element, the context for life being so tough in the 1990s?
I think my expectation on professional cycling was far greater than what it actually was. My bubble sort of burst. I mean, I raced with the Swiss team guys in 87 to 89. It took me years before I had the same level of equipment and actual performance assistance, seriously, with the pro team. They thought the pro team is like, yeah, we pay you, get on with it. That was it. The support of bikes and wheels, material, the Swannies, medical, just everything was just, pretty just normal sort of thing. There was not a lot of resource. There wasn't a lot of budget. The first years we didn't even have a bus. It was just poor in comparison. And I thought I was going to step up when I actually took a step back, I felt, in the first years. And that's saying a lot back in those days when Conti teams didn't have much to start with, pretty much. But as a pro, when you're getting changed out of wet gear after freezing all day, standing outside with just a towel wrapped around you and you're completely naked, come on, is that professional sport? Yeah.
At what point did that sort of start to feel like it was changing and it sort of got a bit more professional in terms of the equipment and things?
Not for me, not until in the 2000s. For me, when we got into 2001, 2002, then we really seen a big step up, I remember first time I got lightweight wheels and the team bought me a pair. I was like kitted out in a candy store. I was like, wow, how cool are these, and starting to get some really cool bikes and carbon bikes. I mean, I had a carbon bike when I was in 88, 89, believe you, with TVT. So, pro teams didn't even have them. There's only one or two. I think Pedro Delgado had a TVT when he won the Tour. And I was riding around the same bike as what he had in a little Conti team in Switzerland. And all the other pros are still riding these steel bikes with downshifters and stuff, I still had downshifters, but, the equipment I had, Campag Super Record and carbon wheels and all that sort of stuff. Well, disc wheels, they weren't carbon wheels in those days. But, yeah, it was the 2000s before I really saw the evolution in what we were doing with racing. I mean, the big thing was we got an extra cog. And when Shimano came out with the new cassette, that was the big evolution in cycling back in those days through the 90s.
I feel that's still the big evolution in cycling these days, isn't it? Campag goes 13 speed. Whoa, this is just mind-boggling because we all need closer ratio cassettes, all of us amateurs. I think it's very important. The cadences is all wrong today. But fast forward from that point, the 2000s when kit started maybe becoming much more recognisable to cyclists today and getting much better, to you being with Cervelo test team and being in the Arenberg forest destroying what once upon a time would have, I guess, been, like you said, the kid in the sweet shop type gear, carbon fiber zip wheels and Vittoria tires, like testing this stuff over the 2.2 kilometers of the worst cobbles, the worst cycling in cycling. Was that a kind of unimaginable moment for you, thinking like, wow, how far I've come here?
It sort of was. I mean, that was part of the reason, to full circle. When I signed, I announced at the end of 23 that I was going to stop. So 24 is going to be my last year. So that was with Alessio Bianchi. And I rode the Tour de France in 24, and that's where I got to talk with Bjarne Riis because I knew him as a rider. And he said, I told him I was going to stop. And he goes, you can do one more year. And then he invited me to become a rider because he was wanting to build out the team, obviously. He wanted to build a team because I was struggling in the classics. They had a good he had a good eye on the tours and big stage races, major stage races, but not on the classics. So he wanted me to join the team as a rider, to lead the team as road captain. And I just didn't want to do the next year. My body was broken from being hit by a car in 98. And it's just more work on dealing with my injuries and trying to keep on the bike than it was to actually spend time on the bike training. So then I came back to him and said, no, I don't want to do it. And then he tried to get me to sign up for the first couple of months of the season. And then I said, no, again, I just don't want to have to spend a whole winter training and then, just do 3 months a year. And that's when he came back and offered me the job as a sports director, which I never, ever thought I would ever do. So that was that first moment, like, wow, okay, am I going to do this? So I took the job, and then within a month I said to him, we really need to do some research and development on this. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, you got shit wheels, shit bikes, pretty much. So the only good thing you got it on them is Shimano. And that was where Cervelo and Zip were just at this point where they really wanted to establish themselves. They were quite new as well. And this is where also Bjarne Riis comes in, because he took brands that wanted to develop. He just didn't take the best. He said, no, I want a brand. I don't want to be locked into contracts with bike manufacturers and what they want me to use. I want to be able to pick and choose the best that's available. So that's what we set about with Cervelo and Zip and Vittoria and all their other material sponsors and partners. And we come up with some, classic winning bikes and Barry Bay winning bikes and Tour de France and Tour of Italy winning bikes. So, yeah, it was a great journey. So, yeah, we did destroy a lot of wheels and a lot of tyres in the process. Like you said, in Arlberg, I think we did about $30,000 worth of wheels in about probably 20 minutes, 45 minutes.
Wowza. So probably the same as, I don't know, a very well-paid pro back when you started, full annual salary.
Yeah, I tell you what, there's a few boys who went back to the US with their tail between their legs. But in saying that, that was the deciding moment which turned Zip around. They built a cobbled road along the side of the factory. They tested it. They did a lot of on-the-ground tests. They just didn't, do mock-ups. And they come back with us with some of these, fantastic wheels. And within 2 years, we were first ones to be using deep dish carbon wheels in Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders and so forth. So I think they put the money where their mouth is and they got on with it.
Yeah. Do you feel like it was maybe partly to do with your apparent understanding of tech? Because, you just mentioned Cervelo. Cervelo started by Gerard Vreeman and Phil White, and they were pioneering aerodynamic road bikes, which at the time was pretty mind-boggling. I think the Soloist, is often cited as like the first true aero road bike, which was kind of out there. And then when, you've got British cycling suddenly back in our country, getting a huge injection of cash to go out and start winning stuff. And then you've got this guy, Dave Brailsford, who says, hey, marginal gains. Is that why you ended up being the guy that Dave Brailsford headhunted for BC? Because you're actually really at quite a sharp end of those marginal gains already in a sport that actually is, to best will in the world. It's a bit kind of basic, isn't it, cycling, I think, up until fairly recently.
Yeah. Look, fair to say, Bjarne Riis was at the forefront of this.
Okay.
But the problem with Bjarne is he has his history. Without his history, he was way in front of Dave Brailsford in what his vision was and what he wanted to do and the team we had around us. So Bjarne was at the head of it. But like I said, he allowed us to get on with things. And to be honest, if it wasn't for Bjarne's background and what happened there with the tour and probably the way emotionally it was a struggle for him and losing the sponsor CSC, it wouldn't have stopped there with him. And I think it was a team that was on the front edge. And I loved it. I enjoyed it. Like, as I mentioned, when I first became pro, I was going, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? And no one had any answers. No one even could wrap their head around it. So it took me, and I said this to Bjarne, and you can quote me on this. I said to Bjarne, it's taken my whole career to find a team that I actually want to be a rider of because you understand. But I said, now I'm a sports director. And he goes, well, let us make change these things for the riders we do have underneath us now. So, yeah, I jumped on board. And that was the conversation we had. And that's where the relationship I had with Bjarne. Unfortunately, I don't see him slightly much today. But yeah, definitely he was at the forefront of marginal gains.
Yeah. Is there, I feel like there's a sort of kinship. I think, you know, you're generationally very different, but we've had Adam Hansen, compatriot to you, born in New South Wales, by the way. So anyone that hasn't guessed, Scott is from Australia. And Adam's now the president of the CPA, the Riders, the Professional Riders Association. And when he was on the podcast, he was talking about equipment and saying how mechanics just laughed at him when he said he wanted 38 centimeter bars because it made him more aero. And so he had to go out and buy his own from the women's range because people didn't make them that narrow. And then also what springs to mind, Alan Piper, another kind of mastermind of Tadej Pogacar's incredible, you know, he didn't need that much help probably, but like winning his first Tour de France. Is there something quite technical about the approach from the Australian camp?
Well, Alan used to hear me speaking. I'd always, you know, we'd go for rides and stuff. So everything I was doing at CC, he was picking my brains about it, obviously, because he was a sports director with Lotto at that time. And then he went to HTC Columbia and so forth. So he was always picking my brains. And I didn't mind sharing it, you know. But, you know, I think we just saw the evolution. We weren't, because we're making that step from Australia, and this is for Adam and Stuart O'Grady and like, because we make that big step from Australia, I think we set the expectations on ourselves so high, we sort of think it's normal for everybody, but it's actually not. I think there's we saw it all with French teams and Italian teams and so forth, and the Italians have probably suffered the most with this. That complacency, oh, we'll just do the same year in, year out. And we've seen it in Spain. We've got one World Tour men's team left. In Italy, zero. You know, Germany's been able to maintain because Germans have a different mentality as well. They want to improve and so forth. But I think, yeah, we just don't quite see eye to eye in that old way. Australians just have a different perspective on it and demand on it, I think. And we have to, like I said, demand so much of ourselves that we demand so much of others.
It's that kind of hard-working mindset you get from working in an abattoir before you turn pro.
You don't need research. But I've always been in this, the ways to the means, and that's what I had to do. I mean, I was earning double what I could get anywhere else, and I only had a short time to turn around, earn my money during the winter so I can go back and race my bike, which was the goal.
Have you ever come up to a Johan Vingegaard in the paddock and put an arm around him and said, mate, the fish factory looks all right. You want to try the abattoir?
It's one of those things, and I see when I saw Vingegaard, that film about him, and you see these different guys, farmers or coming from these sorts of pretty basic backgrounds, and you know, Papa working in a coal miners, it's not the most glorious jobs, these ones, but it's ways to means. And you know, Vingegaard and Lampard and many, many others have all done that sort of work. And like I said, makes you who you are.
Do you think it's also related to why sort of the classics and the Belgian classics are sort of a bit special? Because there's obviously the cycling culture, but it's also like these are the races that are not just, you know, someone's going out and doing 8 watts per kilo. It's more about the grit, about the hard work, about truly suffering over these stupid surfaces. Like, yeah, let's go and ride over something we shouldn't be riding on a bike. It's completely unsuitable for the occasion. Is that sort of where the magic comes from, do you think?
Yeah, I think for me it's understanding it. I think like I hate the cold. I'll be up front. I hate the cold. I much prefer that it's 25 degrees in sunshine, riding classics. But hey, it's a spring classic, not a summer classic. And look, to be honest, the first time I rode the classics, I was going, mate, we're on these perfectly good roads. Why are we doing this climb? What is it, Quarrel or something? I was like, this is crazy. Because I never raced any of these when I was an amateur before turning pro. So I was just racing everything down in Italy, Spain and France. So well. Yeah, look, I think the understanding of cobblestones and racing that, I think it just gives you a different perspective on things and how you approach it. I think I'm sort of see it more from the teams and how you protect the rider and how you look after your equipment and those, you know, those small 1%ers, because, you know, anything can go wrong, will go wrong, and you just need to be able to avoid it, and positioning and so forth. Classics is all about communication as well, because it's so hard to communicate. So, making good planning and strategy beforehand.
I feel like as a equipment guy like that, I know the answer to this, but do you think the sort of development of the technology around like bikes suited for Roubaix and stuff kind of takes away from the magic of it. Like, why aren't they all just riding, you know, 400 PSI on 19 mil tires? You know, what's with, why are they comfortable? You shouldn't be comfortable. That's cheating.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a big debate, isn't it? It's, you know, innovation. How do you stop innovation? I mean, you know, Formula One, I'm a big fan of Formula One, by the way, and I'm always following them, very intrigued in how they manage innovation so that they create an even playing field and so forth. And I think cycling is challenged by this as well, because we don't want to stop the innovation. I think that we probably need to revisit the weight of the bikes is one thing. But yeah, like you say, we're riding 32 mil tyres. I remember a conversation I had with Steven de Jong. I wanted to use 25 mil tyres as a standard in Tour of Flanders for our guys. Oh, 25, they're big. They're big tyres. You know, and Steven de Jong said, yeah, man, it's just, you know, 25, use that for Paris-Roubaix, but yeah, that's a bit big for Flanders. And look what we're using for that. I mean, guys, this is back in, you know, 2007, six. That's not that long ago, you know, and the guys didn't want to get off 23 mil tyres.
And you race, well, I guess you saw that change during your career when helmets became mandatory. It sort of seems a bit, just with obviously with all the stuff that's gone on over the years, all the, you know, horrific incidents and things, how you can't think about it. It's not that far in the past and you just can't imagine racing without them now.
Yeah, it's a funny thing that it's, and we've had these discussions within the Safer group, is that before helmets, it was very uncommon to have a head injury in the race. Very uncommon. I think because we knew how vulnerable we were. So then when we come into helmets and it changed and everyone actually started racing from a young age with a helmet and so forth, and the bikes, the way they were, they could handle, the brakes were improving all the time, even before disc, that people felt safer on the bikes, but they also pushed harder. And the lack of less respect within the peloton. So I think they actually started taking more risks, because even though they knew they're going to lose a ton of skin, I thought, yeah, I'm going to survive. But that wasn't the case. I tell people how I've ridden cobblestone races with no helmet on, a pair of bays. And so look, you don't have to go that many years back. I've done 115 kilometres an hour, or 112 it was actually, downhill in Switzerland following Urs Freuler on a descent. I had no idea what the roads are like, so I just put my life in his hands and followed him. Sort of, if he goes down, I'll go down. And that was through a tunnel. But, you know, and that was definitely on tyres that were not 25 or what they are today, and on old rim brakes. So, but, yeah, the risks, we just were more calculated, I think. But whereas today, I think helmets do offer that sort of buffer of security, a little bit same with cars do today with early airbags and so forth, I think. Look, I'm all about saving lives, 100%. But, yeah, it is. We've come a long way. But I think in the same token, guys, we've adapted. The racing's adapted to where it is. I mean, we didn't have the depth and breadth in the teams back in the day when we were riding with it, or, you know, when the peloton was racing with no helmets. And if there was a sprint at the end of the Giro or the Tour and there's no helmets, there's only half a dozen guys up there elbowing for that. Whereas now we've got 24 teams all trying to fight to be there in the front line with 1 kilometre to go still, you know. So it has changed.
Yeah. So given, just to pick up on something, the kind of idea that you mentioned there, and you alluded to it earlier on, you had a really horrible incident, a really horrible crash in 1998. Was that all the more galling in a sense because as a racer, racing against other racers, you were given kind of respect, or there was sort of space for people to operate in a way where, weirdly, despite the lack of protection, as a racer, you didn't have nearly such a bad crash as when you found yourself in a race with a DS's car nearby, which hit you. Were you sort of left thinking like, bloody hell, that's just, that's so unfair in the circumstances. Like, we try our best and then this is what we get.
Yeah, oof, mate, I had so much go through my head afterwards. I mean, also because I was in a bit of a purple patch, and that's probably to come back to your first question, is that, you know, that year there I was on a very good start. I won a Nocra course and I got third in Pino Cerami, 11th in Gent-Wevel again, 11th in Tour of Flanders. I finished 16th in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, made a mistake there, cost me a top 10. And then here I was in Amstel still riding for the victory and getting taken out 20Ks to go. So not only did I just lose that opportunity of finishing off my spring classics, is that I lost 2 years out of my career minimum. Plus, when I did come back, I could come back to finish seventh in Plouay World Championships, but with a handicap of 21% from my injuries. Plus, you know, just all the other crap that I had to deal with mentally just to get myself straight again.
Yeah.
So you are right, and there's so many different levels of this conversation around just that around itself is the mental aspect of it all, but also what could have been, what should have been, what wasn't. But yeah, that's the beauty about cycling, is that there is the ugly sides of it, but there is some beautiful sides to it too. And watching a guy like Podgorica on Saturday, what that guy can do, you just go, it's just like there's this aura around him that just keeps him there upright and drives him. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Like he's connected to the divine, if you believe it. I don't know what he's connected to, but we can get some of that of you. Amazing.
So when you had a guy on, you know, as a DS, have a fall, have a spill, what were your kind of wise sage words to get them racing again? Because as you say, it's not just the physical, it's a massive mental block for some people, particularly huge if you have an accident.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we can't underestimate the psychology of the sport. For me, it's integral work after incidents, but it's not only just about the race side of it. It's all about how you are within yourself, how you are at home, what you are feeling good about, what makes you tick. I mean, you've got to be careful too. You can't take away the fire within an athlete. Most athletes have got something inside them which makes them, you know, burns. It's a furnace. So you've got to be careful not to put that out, not to extinguish it in a certain way as well, but how to harness that in a rider. And I sort of had to go through to find that again, because in 97 I'd lost that fire because of the situations that were happening within the sport. And you know what I'm talking about there, the big D word. But so I was going to stop in 97, but I got an offer to continue, and that year was 98, and I was back, and I mentally was able to turn myself around with some help in Australia from a mental coach, so a sports psychologist who worked with the national rowing team in the Gold Coast. And he was able to turn me around, and the secret was there, Scott, just you're passionate about it, you love the sport, just go back and have fun. If it's 1 year, 2 years, whatever. So I just found the fun back in the sport again, and it totally changed me. But then I was faced with, like you said, after that other accident, I had to find that again, and it took a lot more, because I was damaged goods, both, you know, ailments, back and legs and hips and shoulder, and then obviously the head injuries that I suffered. So I had to overcome one by one there. So yeah, when an athlete does touch down, it is a very, very important that the teams deal with it correctly. And UCI has brought in a concussion protocol, which I found as well is very important. I've actually, after my own accident, I could recognise that a lot more. So I've actually put three riders, I think if I remember correctly, where I didn't allow them to continue because I thought they were concussed. And they've since known now is that a concussed rider who continues could delay their recovery and to get back on the bike by up to 3 weeks to a month.
Wow.
But by taking a rider out, if they have hit their helmet, they're not, don't finish the race, take 3 days completely off the bike and go through the concussion protocols to actually find out that you are okay to start training again. So the sport has developed in a lot of ways, and you come back to what you said, Will, with the helmets and so forth. Cycling is in a better place than what it was years ago, that's for sure.
In rugby at the moment, they've introduced the thing with, they've got sensors in the gum shields, so when they get hit over a certain amount of G-force, they automatically come off for a check. Do you think that's something that we should look into having that in a helmet? So if a rider's hit in the head, because I think we saw recently in the UAE tours, Adam Yates crashed, looked really bad, got back on, and then they only pulled him out when he said he couldn't remember the crash. And it's sort of a bit like at that point, he should have already been checked.
100%. I think 100% that there needs to be some more sensors. We've got these helmets. I think it should be quite easy to put a sensor in that to be able to detect it. And whether it's a sensor that just turns red, you know, that's green and turns red, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we just need a sensor to be able to see that. And precautionary, take the rider out or run the concussion test with him. So, okay, it's showing red. There's a quick protocol you can do. But I think there also needs to be a way that rider can continue in the race or whatever. But there definitely needs to be some thought given to that. And it is something that's come up within the Safer group on how we can help them manage this teams. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Increase your power, your cardio efficiency, and your brain function. All are possible according to ketone drink experts Delta G.
Developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the National Institutes of Health and funded by DARPA, Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester is the most potent on the market, allowing riders to enter an otherwise unobtainable metabolic state, ketosis, without carb restriction.
Ketosis is seen when there's low blood sugar, with the body turning fat into ketones instead. Usually, you can only increase ketone levels using a low-carb diet or by fasting, but Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester produces ketosis in the presence of normal blood sugar. It's why Delta G can boost power, because you now have three energy sources for muscles: glucose, fat, and ketones. And Delta G can also boost brain function, because both ketones and glucose fuel our brains.
There are a variety of Delta G ketone drinks to use for different situations, so head over to deltagketones.com to explore the science and use the code CYCLIST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that CYCLIST isn't just a podcast. No, CYCLIST is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest Cyclist magazine subscription offers. When you say it's something that came up in the Safer Group, what other kinds of ideas come up and are you guys kind of lobbying for? Because obviously we hear lots about course design, horrible crashes like Fabio Jakobsen. Where are we now and where should we be very, very soon, if not yesterday?
I think the consensus from all of us is behaviour change. And that's for everybody. That's for every stakeholder member of the family. So, you know, obviously I think the biggest behaviour change needs to come from riders, then with teams, coaches, performance directors within the teams. We need to be conscious of what we're pushing the riders to do, but also from the organisers. Not all organisers are seeing safety through the same lens, but they need to be educated. So the behaviour changes through education is going to be, for me, the biggest step. And this is pretty much everybody agrees that within Safer, this is the biggest step forward that we can make. And the quickest as well. That's the low-hanging fruit, but it's a big basket.
I guess, how do you make... It's an interesting question. How do you get that behavior change when the behavior is somehow linked to the success of the rider and the rider's success is linked to whether or not that rider gets paid next season?
Well, I had a conversation with Mark Maddio and I said to Mark about this. You know, we've got the racing environment has changed. We've got cities who are reducing speed in the cities from 60 kilometers an hour down to 30 kilometers an hour. So I said, if we're going to go through there still at 60, 70 k's an hour, there needs to be a behavior change. So that means riders will need to brake, otherwise they're going to crash. And Mark comes back, he says, yeah, but he says, how am I going to tell my riders they need to win if they then need to brake? And I said, well, you can't win if you're laying in the gutter either, Mark. So I don't know. I don't have the solution, but we need to find one. Otherwise, you know, we're going to just continue to see crashes within races.
Yeah. I mean, it's always been that classic thing, which I'm struggling to think of who called it this, but you know, with I think Chris Bourbon, who actually was, would you have crossed over with Chris Bourbon at GAN?
Yeah, I spent a year with Chris in the team in '97.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. And I think there's a quote attributed to him at least, which is that Paris-Roubaix is just, you know, it's a circus, but not in a fun way. It's like the quote is very much like it's a circus in a horrendous way. Like you've got a ringleader and they are kind of whipping the people just to perform and just, you know, hurt yourself. We all like are desperate for a wet Paris-Roubaix or, you know, whatever the monuments are, we're desperate for those conditions. So I also wonder how much responsibility the audience has in making the sport safer, because we're kind of asking for blood in a certain sense, I think, with cycling, in a way that we're not asking for injuries in football. Once upon a time, people didn't not like big crashes in motorsport, I would suggest. A spectacular crash would be a back news picture, whereas maybe now people are over that. But I feel like cycling still has these, you know, the idea of souffrance being like the core of it. If you're not suffering, it's not interesting.
Well, it is heroic. I mean, even though it was a smaller crash, Mathieu van der Poel's victory at World Championships last year was even better because he crashed and got up and still won.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, there's little things. This. And the same with Paro Bay, crashing and then still winning Paro Bay or Flanders or whatever. But look, I think part of my motivational talk to the boys, and this is when Kenchler won his first Paro Bay. We had a horrific start to the season with Kenchler at CSC. Stuart Grady crashed and broke three ribs. Lars Buck, getting Buck, crashed on descent at 90 k's an hour, pretty much took all the skin off his back, could lay on his stomach for like 3 weeks. Christian van der Velde crashed in Catalunya, took himself out as well, broke the collarbone. So pretty much we turned up at the start of Paro Bay with six riders, with two of those guys being neuropros. And we pretty much, the talk was to the boys in the bus, it's like, this is it, we're up against it. We got a good soldier and a leader in Fabian, but this is gladiators, guys. And you have to see yourselves as the underdogs in gladiator. You need to go out and fight the best you can. You're only going to do that as a team. So this is where the whole name Spartacus came up with Fabian. It was from that year before he won, as in the lead up to that Paro Bay, because we knew we were underdone for Flanders. Fabian had it in his head he could win Paro Bay. And we did the recon, our motor pasting back to the hotel, and we prepared it in that way. And I just pretty much put the boys at work and just to profit and ride off the back of every other team, but to keep Fabian as fresh as possible and so forth. And yeah, so that's where Spartacus was born. It's before the first Paro Bay, and the check we talked about and the motivation that we talked about there, and being Spartans in the arena. The underdogs, while everyone else had better equipment and better preparation, doesn't mean we couldn't still win.
Did you also just have it in your mind how to win? Because we all know this amazing story of Magnus Backstead, if you know, by a country mile, the best win of his career, winning Paro Bay in 2004. But you were there. You were the guy pulling him all the way through to the point where he can then end up contesting in the velodrome. So you have that plan, I'm guessing, those race tactics, that knowledge.
Yeah, look, I mean, I was towards the end of my career then that year, and I was fortunate. It was my last year as a pro, so to be able to see someone win Paro Bay was a nice, beautiful gift to be part of, especially, you know, with Tuffy and the team, previous winner, and both Andreas Tuffy and myself went down on the Carrefour des Arbres, but my job was to deliver them at the front at Carrefour des Arbres. But the whole tactics and talking about and discussing the build-up to it was just similar but not the same, but similar to what it was with Fabian. So, yeah, it was sort of a repeat situation, but this time I was in the car, not on the bike, which was a bit warmer and drier too, by the way. same with Magnus. It was an incredible moment. And then to ride with Tuffy from our Carrefour des Arbres after we picked ourselves up and scraped off the mud and got going, we just pretty much rode through and off all the way through to the velodrome, and then to be coming into the velodrome and seeing Magnus there, that was pretty amazing. It was a pretty cool feeling.
Do you, excuse my ignorance, but at that point, were there race radios, contact in a radio form between car and rider?
Yeah.
So would you have heard it all kind of happening, like you almost like listening to a transistor radio yourself? It's like, oh yeah, you and Taffy at the back. Well, not the back, but you know, your race is over, you're just getting to the end. But you know your guy's going for it, and you're there just like super tense whilst you're being slammed by the cobbles.
Well, it wasn't until Mons Pavel that we really saw, boom, we exploded it. We were keeping always within 30 seconds, 20 seconds, 40 seconds, back 30 seconds. So whole rubber bunk team crashed with Mark Waters. And so that was Tuffy, myself, a couple of other guys, and pretty much a whole rubber bunk just chasing the lead group that had Magnus in it. And so we're just riding, because at that point we didn't know. Magnus and Tuffy had the shared leadership, but Tuffy probably was going to be his last Paro Bay, so he didn't want to go down without a fight. So he just asked me, he said, Scott, can you help me try and get back? And so we just rode. But it wasn't until after Mons Pavel, when we're coming towards Carrefour des Arbres, we knew this is done now. It blew out to like a minute 15 in a short space. So we can still hear the radio. Sports Trek was Italian, so he was talking to Magnus, but we didn't hear too much. We were hearing time checks, which was great, and we heard that it split up in the front. But we pretty much, by the time that Magnus got around and finished his lap of honour and we came on and did this, you know, come on to the village round, we could see him standing there with his hands in the air. Well, you knew how late it was.
When you were obviously had a few years as a sports director, what happened to then make you go into looking more at the bigger picture and going into being a race director? Obviously, you worked with at Flanders Classics for a few years and now at the Ride London Classic. Did you want to stop being a sports director, or is it a natural kind of move?
I didn't know when I wanted to stop as a sports director. I probably sort of thought if I did anything, if I stayed within teams, we would go into the management side to get out of the car. I was still carrying bad physical ailments with my back from my incident. So in that last year, coming into the last year when I stopped, I'd been to hospital. I had 3 epidural injections into my back to try and relieve the pain, you know, the ongoing problems I have with it. And one of the things came out of it, I just needed to get out of the car, sitting for, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours a day, you know, driving 2 hours or an hour to the start and then sitting in the car all day and then driving back to the hotels, just killing my back. So I knew I had to make a change. And I wasn't sure though if it stayed meant staying in teams or looking for a complete different direction, which ended up being the latter. It also came down, you know, with some personal things with family and health of my family. So we took a time out and went back to Australia just to try and reset and see what we wanted to do with the kids and family. And that's where I started getting into events in Australia, become race director of a few smaller events, and then Cycling Australia, the federation, asked me to come in and head up their National Road Series. So I went in and set that up and orchestrated that and managed that. And then I got the call up for the Cadell Evans Grosjean Road Race. So set about doing that and put that on its path and set up a strategy to get that to World Tour as quick as possible, not only the men's but then the women's. So, you know, went about setting all that up as well. And then, yeah, then with what I was doing there, I obviously still have my connections here in Europe, and that's when Walter van den Halter, the owner of Flanders Classics, approached me to do the Great War of Remembrance race in 2018, and pretty much I finished that one, and he said, do you want to be a race director at Flanders Classics? And I thought he meant Tour of Flanders. He says, no, all of Flanders Classics races. Okay, yeah. Sure, why not? Let's have a crack. Let's see. Let's go. And that's where I've been now doing this. So pretty much that's all grown from doing six races to where we have 12 races in the beginning of the season, both men's and women's. So either the Pro Series or World Tour, to we've got 3 summer races and then men's races. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
So what does the role of a race director actually entail? Are you like looking at the routes and everything? Or are you looking more kind of bigger picture?
Everything. You know, like for example, when I 2019, I started with Ride London Classic. So Kevin Ash contacted me from London Marathon Events. So Kevin has his background as the event director who worked on a lot of big major events, Paris, for example. Kevin and Lisa Rawlidge worked on both on this together. They did some time at Sweet Spot before they went to do this. Then as a legacy event, this is where the Ford Ride London Classic was born, or Ride London Classic was born, both men's and women's races. So when they contacted me in 2019, I knew the event and so forth, and they came with the concept. They had an agreement with the Mayor of London plus Transport for London. So they had a long-term strategy. And they said to me, what are we going to do? Okay. So it's pretty much throw out everything that's been existing that they had done before to reinvent how they want to do events, because London Marathon events knew everything about running races. Let's face it, London Marathon is one of the best or the biggest in the world, I'd say. They wanted to try their hand at cycling events because they really believed that the reach that they could gain by doing cycling in the health perspective and getting young people on bikes and transport, the change the way people see bicycles, but also transport and commuting. That was very important to them. So Hugh Brasher had a vision and he wanted to set about to it. And obviously then COVID-19 came along. So then it was this big rethink from, okay, what do we do now? We've got a bit of time to think about it. And that's where the whole concept, the ideas come about of letting the men's race drop away and then going from a one-day race, women's race in London, to building it to a stage race. And the vision was to get to the point that we have 3 days in 23, 4 days in 24, and to 5 days in 25. It's still a vision. Unfortunately, we were knocked back on achieving our 4 days in 24. They didn't want to give us the extra day. So we're hoping that in 25 we'll get those 2 extra days and have a 5-day stage race in there. So to get back to answer your question, yeah, pretty much everything from top to bottom, everything inside the barricades, dealing with federations, whether it's UCI or British Cycling, or dealing with commissaires, right through to teams, riders, police, and so forth. So yeah, there's a lot to be done. We built a complete different team, a new team of drivers and security. We have new safety managers that all follow the courses. So the benchmark is really high, guys. As you know, that I'm very passionate, but also very meticulous in safety levels. So that was always going to be the level where it had to be the highest possible. But also I was very meticulous in how we went about that with the right team, people who wanted to be part of it and understood it. And we've been very fortunate to find all those people. Some of those people are in-house already at London Marathon events, and some we've recruited new people into the fold. And it's been very exciting. We spend meticulous time in designing the course so it will allow for us to have these safety aspects to it. So we don't say we're going to go A to B and draw a line. We really do look at each road that's used and what it looks like. If it's got traffic, road furniture on it that could hinder the rider's safety, or the type of road it is. And we're also looking at the flow and the pressure on the race, so that we create a dynamic race that riders want to race, first of all, that they love to race. I mean, you've got to race a circuit, and then you just got a circuit that people just race. We want it to be a rider circuit. We want them to want to race, and they enjoy it. But then also looking at aspects of wind and terrain to play into this, you know. So team tactics can vary from one team to the next and from one year to the next on the same course depending on weather conditions. So a lot of time and thought goes into doing this, Will.
Yeah. I've spoke to Kevin for this podcast. It'll be an episode that goes out in the future. And interestingly, and I thought it's quite funny, he said one of the hardest things is planning around individual people. So he's coming at it, or we were speaking specifically about the Ride London Essex 100, so the amateur side of things, and having to accommodate the fact that I think, you know, it's a weekend, you end up with people having weddings, and you have to be able to make sure that people can get to the wedding. You can't just shut off some lovely little parochial road in Essex because someone might have a church down there, and where's everyone going to park? So that's obviously one side of it. But the thing that occurs to me, Will and I were discussing this before, is how do you make that race not just safe, not just accommodating to people with, you know, births, marriages and deaths, but also interesting in terms of features to generate the racing, specifically in a country or in a part of the country which, let's face it, is quite featureless for cycling. That is quite a big ask to, you know, try and make something. You haven't got grand mountains and you haven't particularly got cobbled streets or dirt, you know. So where does your mind go? What are you looking for to satisfy the racing side, you know, to make it that racer's race?
Well, the first step for us, and it is a good question, is when Essex wanted to be a partner. I mean, Essex is very much part of the story from that legacy. They were part of the Olympic Games with the Mountain Bike Park. And for them, that was a no-brainer. They wanted to be part of this story and the 10-year vision of Hugh Brasher and London Marathon events. So then we just said about what makes Essex. For me, it was like, okay, what is Essex? What is it? You know, like we've got the Dolomites. You know, you're going north of Italy, you've got the Dolomites, they're iconic. So let's see how we can best use that. Well, here we got the best part of Essex. So we looked at Chelmsford, Colchester, Saffron Walden. I mean, Saffron Walden's is not new to the sport of cycling with the Tour de France that's been through there. But then we also had Maldon, which was pretty much not being used. And Maldon's a beautiful little harbour city town. And then finding what has it got to offer? And so we found North Hill, and we found that we could do a loop there. And then Saffron Walden, the same to the west when we go into Hertfordshire. We're doing a stint down through Hertfordshire this year. And they're super keen to have cycling coming into their county. And so we can utilize the climbs from there in the beginning of the race to, you know, open it up a little bit. So it's just trying to get the film that I run in my mind on how we can piece these together and how can we bring them in, so one chapter into the next and so forth. And it's not always about, as I mentioned before, making as hard as you can in terrain, but making it work for the riders and the teams. So and this is probably my background in strategy with riders and races, how can we challenge the riders and the teams but also give them that pay, that space as well, that pause, so they can regroup and go again, you know, so collect themselves. It's sort of like that, that time out in the basketball court, or that, you know, injury time on football where they stay laying on the pitch for a while so everybody can get there, gather themselves and get a few more tactics from the coach going through and so forth. And that's how I sort of look at it, guys. And I think Essex has got quite a lot to offer. You just need to look hard enough for it.
With all the stuff that's happened, obviously, in the last few months, sort of come out with Sweet Spot and the Tour of Britain and the Women's Tour sort of folding and hopefully being brought back by British Cycling. Does that put pressure on you as sort of the last pro race, especially World Tour race?
Not at all. We don't feel pressured at all. I mean, why that is that we did our due diligence through COVID. We spent our time to really look at everything. We stripped everything back to say, okay, what's worked in the past and what hasn't. So we identified that. And obviously, London Marathon Events had a different operation then and a different race director. So we took the time to look at that. I had no set ideas that I knew everything for it. I didn't, because racing in the UK is very different to Belgium, Australia, France, or Italy. So legislation, one thing, traffic is completely different. So we needed to look at how we can best work with that. So, yeah, we didn't really fear, because we did the work, Will. We went in and we analysed it. We pulled it apart. We put it back together again. So we feel that we've got a very robust strategy moving forward with this event. And as I mentioned, we were ready for having four stages this year, and with our goal to having 25 stages, potentially going to six stages maximum. We never saw ourselves as getting more than six stages for a women's race. I don't think UK needs it. We don't think that the teams need it. We don't think that the world calendar needs it. But obviously, if we could get to that, that would be our ceiling. But we want to do it well. I mean, we've got London. It's an epic city. I mean, it's world famous. Everyone knows it. The finish on the mall, that's equivalent to Champs-Élysées. I mean, you know, everyone knows the mall. So we've got that already. And we've got all the counties surrounding London who want a piece of this pie. So we've got other counties who very much want to be part of this. And they're also part of the strategy moving forward that we'll bring in new counties. So I'm super excited about it. I just think that we need the time to unravel it, or not unravel it, to undisclose it to the public and to the world. And so it's very exciting. As far as British Cycling coming in, I think it's great that the Federation can step up to help cycling continue. I mean, Britain needs to have more races. With how popular cycling is in the UK and the achievements of the British riders, to only have a one men's World Tour team and not a women's World Tour team or any pro teams, it's a bit surprising, to be honest. And then same with the races. It would be lovely to see there's more races in the UK. Though, you know, I'm not sure what British Cycling plan to do here is to give a leg up to make sure the race continues, but it also becomes a little bit the question of, does this distract them from being the federation and busy with what they need to do as a federation, as a governing body, when they start looking at doing bike races and being an organizer as well? So, you know, there's a ways to go, and I think British Cycling will, you know, work their way through that and then hopefully find a good pathway forward that cycling stays, continues to prove. We definitely got to go up, not down.
Why do you think the landscape looks as it does? As you say, there is an enormous appetite for the consumer level. You know, you've got a lot of people participating in cycling, buying into cycling in other ways, and they want to watch races. And yet, as you say, the UK, Britain doesn't serve those races up. Why is that, do you think?
I think the model needs to be looked at. I think the whole thing needs to be similar to what we've done with Ride London Classic. It needs to be looked at and said, what needs to stay and what needs to go? And that's what we've done. I'm not saying British Cycling need to do this, but I think organisers within the UK need to look at this again. You cannot take what is successful in other countries. You can look at it and see if it is applicable, but in a lot of cases, it's not. What Belgium does is not applicable everywhere else either. There's parts of what happens in Belgium can work in the UK, because there is similar types of roads and terrain, but the people behind it aren't quite of the same thought and mentality of cycling. But there still is a lot of people. So I think thinking about how the races are designed, the starts, the finishes, and everything in between. I think that's where people need to get more creative in developing courses and races.
Yeah, because it struck me ever since I rode, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the event, the Fred Whitten, which is Big Sportive in the Lake District. I've ridden lots of events in the name of this magazine, not very well, I might add, but that was like all over the world. But that was by far and away one of the hardest. And being in that area of the country, it just really speaks to one day type racing. It's almost quite Belgian. You know, it's pretty grisly on the wrong day. It's got some enormously tough climbs, but nothing's particularly high. And it has something of a kind of rounded sort of charm about it in a way where it looks of its type. You know, it's very much placed where it is in the same way that racing in Flanders looks very Flandrian, looks very Belgian. And I wonder, have you guys talked internally about looking to serve up some one-day races? Because I know we've got the Rutland-Melton Cycli Classique, which I think at the moment is the only other UCI international race other than the Ride London Classique, which is a World Tour race that Britain has. And you think, couldn't there be more of those? Couldn't we do one-day races really well?
Look, in a whole, and look, this isn't solely for British cycling. I mean, Australian cycling is the same problem here. I think the grassroots National Road Series needs to be looked at. I mean, that's the core of everything. And this is how race organisers can develop and potentially take it from being an NRS event to a bigger event. But you need to cut your teeth somewhere. And organisers need to start at a younger age and develop and grow. And as you do so, you gain experience and so forth, and hopefully gain attraction from big sponsors. And yes, we have thought about other events around UK. I've picked out some beautiful places that I think that would make for great races, using what I know from Australia and Belgium, and now having a very thorough understanding of the UK. Like, I mean, I raced and was sports director for a few Tour of Britain's, done a few Tour of Ireland's, and raced the Liege Classic back in the day, and then the Wincanton Classic when it was down south. I know all great races and very tough races. And you are right. I think there's something very special of UK, whether you're at the north of the UK or the south of the UK, that really just identifies to that region. Similar to when you're doing a race in Brittany in France, or you're doing it down the south of France, you pretty much see straight away where you are in the world. And the UK's got the same. So I think there is massive amount of potential in the UK, guys. But I do think, as I mentioned before, we need to be more creative in what we're trying to do here. So if you can get those creative types and really think about it, and doing the designs of the course in the correct way, you'll have a win-win.
So could you tell us one little gem, one overlooked place in the UK that if someone said, you've got a mate coming over from Australia, and they say, Scott, I'm bringing my bike, which is going to be very expensive to get it all the way from Australia. Maybe they can rent one. Anyway, I'm going to have a bike. I want to go cycling, but I don't want to go to Box Hill. I don't just want to go to the lakes. That's where everyone goes. Where should I go?
I mean, we've sort of seen Scotland. Scotland's got some amazing roads up there. I took a little bit of time out in between the two weekends of the road races last year. But then when I came down, driving back down through the north, I took the time to see there's some big open mountains there. And they're gnarly and they're terrible and terrible weather. But I think if you just want to catch something which is amazing, I mean, the southeast pocket of the UK is really nice. It's beautiful down that way. To be honest, I love in and around parts of, you know, what we're trying to achieve, I'm promoting ourselves here. What we're trying to achieve here with the Ride London Classic is to potentially have 5 to 6 days, ultimately with the last day being in London. That means 5 days around London. You've got some of the most beautiful landscape and riding areas in around London itself without even going up to Yorkshire, for example. Yorkshire is fantastic as well. I mean, there's been years and years of having racing up there, and it's got a strong pedigree of racing and support. I think also Wales has got its charm as well, over in the southwest pocket. I think you can make this about anything, guys. I think I'd be putting my hand in the fire too if I was to say only one area as well. But I probably am trying to keep myself out of trouble here, guys.
No, Scott, that's absolutely brilliant. I feel like I've never left a conversation feeling so buoyant about the UK, which right now, looking out of my window, it's raining and it's about 2.5 degrees. So thank you for that. That's pepped me up no end. But also thank you so much for giving us the time and spinning some brilliant stories. The Ride London Classic will be the 24th to the 26th of May. Am I right in thinking?
That's correct.
Yeah. Excellent. So yeah, three stages, amazing racing. Get to London or watch it on your telly. Is it the sort of thing that will be televised?
Yeah, so just some stats on it, guys. It's three stages, 150 kilometres day one, 140 day two, stage two, and then 80-something kilometres, I forget where we landed, 82, 83 kilometres on stage three around the mole. We're hoping to have over 100 kilometres, but we're a bit time poor there because we bump into the news, which is on BBC. So BBC is showing all three stages, with BBC Two showing day three, stage three. Super excited about that. We've got a big announcement coming up on the 14th of March, so be ready for that. Very, very cool things happening. And, having Ford on board as our partner, plus all of our other partners, like Essex has come on board until 26 and Ford is on board until 25. That's just showing how much interest there is in cycling. And there's more to come, guys. There's more to come. So we're very motivated, and we're ready to go out there and kick some more goals with this event. And hopefully all of UK will get behind it. I know there's lots of young girls who are looking up to the stars that will be there this year, and boys. So we invite everybody, mums and dads, along to see the race. And, that's part of what we're doing this for. And it's part of what Hugh Brashel wants, is that cycling is reaching the young families and the young children to get into sport and have a healthier lifestyle. And obviously, use cycling as a way to commute instead of taking a car.
Brilliant. Scott, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Lovely to talk to you. Cheers.
Scott Sunderland, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, Scott, for joining us on the show. It does make me think, Will, as our resident sports pundit, across all sports.
All sports.
All sports. Do you know anything about kabaddi? I reckon you do.
I've heard the name.
You've heard the name.
And once you tell me what it is, I'll be able to...
It's kind of like British Bulldog. Do you remember British Bulldog?
Yeah.
But you have to say kabaddi as you try and cross from one side of the kabaddi court to the other without getting tapped. And that's how you kind of... one team is trying to tap the other team out, so it's whoever's kind of left standing. And so it's one breath, essentially. You go... kabaddi, 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 kabaddi. And when you run out of breath as well, if you haven't made it across without in your one breath, then you're also out. I think that's how it's played. Anyway.
No, I've never heard of that. That sounds bonkers.
Do you not remember Transworld Sport?
Yeah, I do actually.
Yeah. So,
but not that particular
segment. Back in the day when cycling was so niche, you'd often only see it on Transworld. Well, you wouldn't often only. You'd only see it on Transworld Sport alongside other niche sports such as kabaddi. And somewhere in an alternative universe, this is the Kabaddi Magazine podcast, and cycling is still a niche sport. Anyway, but Will, as our resident sports pundit, across all sports, except for kabaddi, who do you think will win the Ride London Classique, or Classic, if you just want to say it in the non-QUE way?
Well, it's spelled in the QUE way, to be fair.
It is.
But it's kind of impossible not to pick one person to win because
only one person can win.
Ain't that the truth? But world champion Lotte Kopecky is set to ride in Ride London Classique, so why on earth would I pick anyone else?
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, Lotte Kopecky, which is in the alternative universe, everyone's cycling their bikes going Kopecky, 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 and you have to get to Maldon before you've run out of breath. Okay, Lotte Kopecky, I'm going to go and put some money on that. And in the meantime, I'm going to say goodbye because you and I probably should go and do some other work because you've been on holiday, so I bet you've got loads of cyclist.co.uk website stuff to catch up on.
Nothing. It's all organised. It's all on the go.
Oh, you did it all remotely. Did you organise?
We're actually, for the day of recording, it's all in hand. It's all done.
It's all done. The bell's just gone in the background for the millionth unique user of the fortnight, so that's good. Numbers are up like never before.
Everything's up.
Everything's up.
It's up, up, up.
Up, up, up.
What I need to do now, though, James, and this is a tease, mm-hmm. I need to write the big ride for the next issue of Cyclist magazine.
Where did you go?
I went to the Monte Grappa.
The Monte Grappa?
I did.
Where is that?
It's just north of Bassano del Grappa in Italy.
The home of Basso Bikes, I believe, is around there somewhere.
Correct. Basso Bikes, of which they helped us do the ride.
Did they? I didn't just drop that in for you to be able to say that, but that's nice. And also,
it worked out really nicely.
Also the home of Grappa, I guess.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, what's Grappa made from?
Something to do with alcohol.
Yeah, that's made from the stuff that is left over from making wine.
Which makes sense because it's Prosecco region around there.
Yes, that is the Prosecco region around there. Anyway, top of Monte Grappa is an amazing war memorial. So that's sort of two. Are you ticking off international war memorials? Is that your new jam?
Yeah, that is my new jam.
Where to next? The Cenotaph?
Every week. Well, I guess it might be time to go back to Northern France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, on that note, I mean, Northern France has got terrible cycling, let's be honest. It's really flat. Wonderful food. Really terrible cycling. Good bike paths, though.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so I guess it depends how you're looking at it. I take that back. Northern France has got wonderful cycling.
And with that, you're cancelled.
Yeah, I think I was cancelled several sentences ago. Increase your power, your cardio efficiency, and your brain function. All are possible, according to ketone drink experts Delta G.
Developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the National Institutes of Health and funded by DARPA, Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester is the most potent on the market, allowing riders to enter an otherwise unobtainable metabolic state, ketosis, without carb restriction.
Ketosis is seen when there's low blood sugar, with the body turning fat into ketones instead. Usually, you can only increase ketone levels using a low-carb diet or by fasting. But Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester produces ketosis in the presence of normal blood sugar. It's why Delta G can boost power because you now have three energy sources for muscles, glucose, fat, and ketones. And Delta G can also boost brain function because both ketones and glucose fuel our brains.
There are a variety of Delta G ketone drinks to use for different situations. So head over to deltagketones.com to explore the science and use the code CYCLIST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that CYCLIST isn't just a podcast. No, CYCLIST is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest CYCLIST magazine subscription offers.